Welcome to Amnesty International's comedy podcast series. This year, Amnesty's had exclusive backstage access at two of the biggest events on the comedy calendar, the 2014 Edinburgh Festival Fringe and the Balham Comedy Festival in London. We'll be bringing you a series of interviews with some of the greatest stand-up comedians working today, and along with finding out about the business of laughter, we'll be chatting about life, politics, and human rights. Today, we're backstage at the Balham Comedy Festival in London to talk to American funny man Reginald D. Hunter. He'll be filling us in on how a dare got him into comedy, his plans to perform in Russia, and how he's delving into the music of the Deep South in his latest documentary. Reginald D. Hunter?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for joining Amnesty backstage at the Balham Comedy Festival. How are you?
Probably better than I deserve. Thank you for asking.
Oh, I thought you were great. Well done. How did you feel?
I appreciate it, brother.
How did it go?
I gave a decent account of myself. Well, more accurate, I got away with it. But you wouldn't want to make a living off the difference. There was lovely people. It was a hot room, and it was my first comedy gig in months. And it's like, it was like maybe like the last 5 minutes of my set, I thought, oh shit, I think I remember how to do this.
Well, you couldn't tell. You couldn't tell you've been away for a while.
Thank you, young man. You're very agreeable to talk to.
So what have you been up to in the intervening period?
I've been getting into adventures. I went to Australia and New Zealand to find my funny bone again after a tumultuous 2013. And then I went and filmed the documentary in the States for about 6 weeks, and it was very exacting. And so between jumping time zones and different projects, and even trying to stick in seeing the family in between here and now, it's been a strong minute since I've been, you know, telling jokes.
So you've not been slacking?
Come on, man. I don't want to lie. I mean, I'm a slacker. I slack when I can. But when it's time to work, I work. But if there's a little crack where I can slack, then I slack.
Talking of work, you're taking your new show up to Edinburgh.
I was, but I'm not doing that this year.
How come?
The Enterprise has been diverted on a new mission.
What are you up to?
Well, I just finished filming a documentary, and me and my brain trust thought that it might be a little much coming straight in from that and trying to hurry up and get ready for Edinburgh. And I got a personal rule. As much as I love doing Edinburgh, I promise myself that I won't make myself just do it if I ain't got nothing to say. Mm. And I'm getting ready to do my first proper European tour, you know, going to visit, you know, Russia and Germany and a few places in there that no English-speaking stand-up has been. So I wanted to get my mind right for that.
Wow, yeah, that sounds like it'll take a lot of preparation. How do you think your comedy will go down in Russia?
Well, that's a very good question.
We will see,
I guess. Yeah, to be continued.
So if I can I take you back to your early days?
We stay there when we get there?
You originally came here from Georgia to study at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts.
That is correct.
So what was the career plan back then?
I had, the loose one was that I was going to try to be an actor, and I felt like I had some aptitude at it. But when I looked at my competitors, I can't sing, I don't dance, you know, and so I thought, before I go to New York or Los Angeles, let me go over here with these British people and let them give me some accreditation, and maybe that accreditation will buy me 5 extra minutes over there, back in the States. And I thought, as a backup plan, if the acting thing didn't work, I was going to be a chef. And of course, you know, life is what happens when you're trying to carry out your plan. And before I knew it, I found myself starting to do stand-up. And the first gig that I did, it went very well. And I was just doing it for a laugh. But and the audience knew that it was my first time. It went very well, and well enough for me to think, well, I'm going to try to do a second gig. Mm. And that went very well. And I did about 5 of those, and then I thought, I think I'm going to write some jokes. And then, because at that point, I didn't have nothing but, you know, an accent and an attitude.
But your first gig was a dare, wasn't it?
It was a prompt. It was like, you know, sitting at the bar, and I was ranting because I was broke, no plan, no woman. and I was drinking. I was talking loud, but when I'm ranting, I'm kind of funny like that. A couple dudes at the bar was like, "You're funny, man. You should do the comedy night." And I was like, "Man, maybe."
So, when you started performing, did you see a big difference between an American sense of humor and a British one?
The only difference I've seen between a British sense of humor and everybody else's sense of humor is British people is the only one who asks you that question. They're very preoccupied. But British people are very proud of their sense of humor. Like, no one has a sense of humor the way we have a sense of humor. Huh? What kind of sense of humor you got? Huh? We have a 1,000-year tradition. Yeah, we're sarcasm. Yeah, and it's like, I think all humor, comedy, basically is sex, religion, politics. The difference is in the phrasing.
Hmm.
That's a general way I see it.
And we're just a bit more proud of our sarcasm.
Yeah. Just, you know, I think y'all started some wars with sarcasm. I don't know.
Now, I heard
the
you have...
Sark that lost the, launched 1,000 ships.
I heard you have two sisters that you think are actually funnier than you. Does a good sense of humor run in the family?
I got one sister who's funnier than me. My nephew Chauncey is the funniest. My father is the second funniest. He used to be the funniest, but he's old now. And then there's my sister. She's come in third, and I'm actually fourth funniest, but I'm number one in confidence.
And that's the key.
That's it.
And you talk about your nephew in your show, don't you? You've got a nickname for him.
Yeah, I do. Deep Nuts. He's my undercover man. Deep Nuts.
And I read that when you were a kid, you wanted to be a politician and maybe even president.
Yep, I had that dream as a kid.
So do you still think the world needs changing?
Well, I think the world is changing. I think change is a constant. Isn't that what science tells us? I think the problem with the world in regards to change is we keep trying to fit existing old narratives. It's like when you look at the movies, it's like every few years or so, they're going to trot out the same movies, remakes, Gatsby or King Kong or Godzilla. And it's like, at a certain point, how many of these do we need?
Mm.
It's like, you know, I heard that there's talk of remaking The Godfather. Why would you do that?
That's crazy.
I mean, like, you know, if you want to remake The Godfather, go ahead and remake Spice World, the movie, first. We see how you do. And then you earn the right to talk to me about The Godfather. You remake something that was bad, you know? But I think there's so many existing tropes when it comes to religion, race, gender roles. And it's like, if things don't fit the pre-existing narrative, then our world has a hard time with it.
Hmm.
And we need new narratives. We need narratives other than good will always defeat evil because our world proves something otherwise.
Hmm.
And we need a different narrative other than all the cute, beautiful people will find love at the end because a lot of people don't.
Hmm.
And just, or that romantic love in children is the highest, best love. That ain't so either. It's just the most common and the most endorsed.
Hmm.
So those are just some examples off the top of my head.
Hmm.
Imagine now. Get some spiky Twitter feeds.
We won't go into the Twitter thing. Don't worry. But can comedy change things?
Well, I think comedy can add to the language. You know, we can add words to the lexicon. We can be a part of the zeitgeist. But I mean, like, when Joan Baez thought that, you know, songs would change the world, I imagine the Resident Evil was sitting at the TV going, "She's really going to try and whoop us with songs." No, we have missiles. She doesn't know. She's going to use songs. So change the world, and change the world into what? I think it's a vanity. I used to want to make people think. When I first got into stand-up comedy, I was like, I want to make people think. And I was like that for the first 7 or 8 years. And then maybe about 5, 6 years ago, I began to realize how arrogant and presumptuous that was. You know, here I am, you know, there are massive and unexplained gaps in my education. But I'm going to make people I don't know think. Make them think what?
Hmm.
You know, you make yourself think and enjoy doing it and let people enjoy your thought process and your joy of doing it.
Hmm.
But I think it's an arrogant thing to suggest that you're going to make people think. The suggestion is that you do and they don't.
Hmm. Yeah. And is it true that venues you play sometimes won't use the title of your show? How do you feel about that kind of censorship?
I don't really care. I mean, the people who make money off me, they get a little upset about it, you know, and some of the fans do, but it's just, I mean, what's really nice is that when venues here have trouble with titles on my show, it's because of the word nigger. But I'm getting ready to do my European tour, and I'm doing it largely in Russia and Germany. And the title of my show is called A Nigger Runs Through It.
Like the Brad Pitt film.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I like you. But the thing is, them Russian and German people couldn't give a toss about it. They're like, yeah, okay. It's like, yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, this will be interesting.
They've not even seen the original Brad Pitt film.
No, they probably haven't. have you ever seen the Brad Pitt film, The Assassination of Jesse James, by the coward Robert Ford?
I didn't feel the need to watch it.
I'm like that about some movies.
No, only because it's completely given away what happens in the title.
Oh, you might be too witty for your own good.
So you often confront issues around race in your act. Do you think this has led you to be seen by some as a kind of arbiter as what is racist? And does that annoy you?
Anything that happens a lot, it can get up your nose a bit. But I had to be realistic and realize that I work and live around a lot of white people who ain't been around a lot of people different than them. And so it's kind of human nature and everything.
Mm.
And when they come to me with stuff like that, I give them the best answer I can. But I try to make them understand as well. It's just because you're not black doesn't mean that you are unable to understand racism. We're not, you know, just...
Because I remember it happening on Have I Got News For You, I think. I think Ian Hislop actually asked you whether something was racist, which just seems odd.
Yes. I remember years ago, I had a bit about it. It was like this lady from BBC rang up. There was some minor racist controversy of the day. And during that period, they was ringing me up often to comment. And I was like, I don't want to do it. And he was like, we don't really want you to do it. And I said, well, if I do it, then you have to introduce me as Reginald, King of the Blacks. If you do that, then I'll speak on it.
That's fair enough.
I'm King of the Blacks.
And I've heard you say that you actually prefer absurdist comedy more than socially charged issue comedy.
Well, so absurdist comedy make me laugh.
Hmm.
I mean, like... It's like the stuff I do that make me laugh, it'd be my more ridiculous, silly stuff. But sometimes, you know, when you're tired and on the road, you get to some of that harder stuff, whether it's about racism or gender politics or sexual politics, and you know that there's going to be an uphill climb with some of the people you're looking at, and your body's like, oh, why can't I say easier stuff? But I don't do absurdist humor for other people well.
Yeah.
For me, I crack myself up with it. But if I was going to try to make my living doing absurdist humor, well, I might not be sitting here having this interview with you.
Yeah. Well, we are glad you are here.
Glad being
here. And it's now time for your human rights questions.
Okay. So. I'm all into that, boy. I believe humans should have rights now.
Excellent.
I've always said that since I was about 8.
So Amnesty International defends freedom of expression.
So they say.
Do you think comedians should be able to say what they want?
Do I think comedians... I think anybody should be able to say what they want. But I think the same person has to be willing to deal with the consequences of what they say. It's like they used to have like white comedians say, oh, you can get away with saying the word nigga, and I can't. And I said, no, you can. But like me, you have to be willing to deal with the consequences. And for me, sometimes the consequences came in the form of empty seats, you know, or harsh write-ups, or angry people, particularly black people.
Your own family, I think.
The black people in my family. My nephew, Deep Nuts, was explaining it to me. He said, you have to understand that your sisters and brothers marched in the civil rights movement. Some of them had Black Panther leanings. And it's hard for them to pick up the newspaper every 6 months and see you going nigga, nigga, nigga. They feel it in their body.
Yeah.
That just recently came to my attention, you know.
So they have seen your act?
Most of them haven't seen it live.
No.
But YouTube has done more to put divisions in my family.
It's telling tales on you.
Deep Nuts told me, he said, when you look on YouTube and look at you, the first 26 pages is your nice sociable stuff. But if you get after page 26, that's when things start to hurt.
And secondly, the Conservative Party have said they might scrap the Human Rights Act after the next election. Can you tell me what human rights mean to you, and do you think human rights are viewed differently in America compared to the UK?
I think it's all, how do I phrase this? I think a human right is obvious and basic, and I think that it's the corporatization of our society that makes us put simple, obvious things down on paper, or makes have to declare them. That's, if something feels redundant about having to fight for human rights when the people you're fighting against are human. It's breathtaking to me. And sometimes I can't tell if people in power are evil or are they like many people and they think the world is like the group of people they're in. You know, I think a lot of conservatives think that the world either is or should be like their small cluster of friends. And that, too, is a vanity. I just, like, I look at George Bush when he was in office, W, and I look at him and I think, he seems to be unaware of how disliked he is. How can he not know? But he's waving and smiling. He looks happy. But that's because I suspect he'd be with mostly the people who be like him. And the people who be like him, every time he pick up USA Today, they go, no, let me keep that. But you go over there and have a drink.
I understand what you mean. The people just stay within their own circle and don't let anything else interrupt
them. It's like sexual politics. Like, you know, the sexual politics where I come from in terms of do's and don'ts and what's cool and what's sexy and what's not, it's different there than it is here. But in Britain, you go 10 miles in any direction, and the sexual politics slightly change. Like, I've spoken to British people, and they're like, well, you know, everyone does this. And it's like, no, they don't even, not everyone even does this up the road. But within your cluster, if you haven't gone out of it much, you know, your world can be the world to you, you know? And I think, I suspect that a lot of people who get into office, they're coming from their world. And they're trying to make, I don't know. You know what? That's an incomplete thought. I was thinking that last night, but when I stopped thinking about it, I thought to myself, I need to think about this some more. And I didn't start thinking about it again until I was talking to you there. And that's the wrong time to be thinking about
that's
it.
That's fair enough.
Thank you.
Well, finally, let's end on a light note. You've just been working on a new documentary about Southern music, right? Yes. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, I've been working on a documentary about Southern music.
Southern music, Southern in terms of...
It's actually old-time Southern music. Old-time Southern, like from blues to bluegrass. From blues to bluegrass to Robert Johnson to Lynyrd Skynyrd, that kind of thing.
So we're talking Memphis, New Orleans.
Did Memphis, yeah. Did all that. Yeah. Did a lot of Tennessee.
How long were you out there for?
Six and a half.
Wow. Did you go down to those crossroads where?
Yeah, actually, did some filming there.
Soul to Soul? What was his name?
Soul to Soul.
The guy who sold his soul at the crossroads.
Robert Johnson.
Robert Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I went and stood at the crossroads. And you know what's depressing? You get to the crossroads, and one corner is a gas station, and another corner is a donut shop, and another one is a burger joint. It's like the devil decides to franchise out, baby. The devil is a capitalist.
I know. So when can we see that?
The people in charge say January.
On the BBC.
To release it, BBC Two.
Well, I can't wait to see. I'm a big fan of that kind of music.
Yeah, well, and if you did that kind of music, because a lot of the music I ain't heard of. And it's like, yeah, the BBC people, they was like, well, surely you know this song. You're from the South.
Yes.
And it's like, well, we don't really do a lot of Lynyrd Skynyrd in the ghetto. I mean, you know, Sweet Home Alabama is lovely. Don't get me wrong. Everybody know it, but it's like, but they went back and did some old time songs. And we actually explored Southern Gothic. Southern Gothic is a thing, not just in music, but in books.
Yeah.
And all Southern Gothic is just romanticized murder in the South. We do murder very well in the South.
Right, yeah.
Certainly do it often.
Well, Reginald D. Hunter, thank you very much for giving us your time.
Brother T.
And good luck in Russia.
From Georgia with love, baby.
And I can't wait to see the documentary, and I can't wait to see you live at some point during
the year. I sure appreciate it. Tim, you use the company. Take care.
Thank you very much. If you're interested in learning more about human rights or joining Amnesty International, then please go to our website, amnesty.org.uk, and make sure you don't miss our next episode. Here's a sneak peek.
I'm so bored of makeup. I don't have the time to take it off at the end of the evening. I never wear makeup unless it's on stage. But then I just couldn't quite. I just thought, it's showbiz, isn't it? Slap on a bit. It almost seems disrespectful to the audience not to make a bit of an effort with makeup. And then I thought I wouldn't wear a bra because I'm really over bras as well. Really hate wearing bras.
So you just turn up in your pyjamas.
Just turn up in my pyjamas and go, it's about the words, man. I don't know.